Okay. So how's everybody in the world? I know we have people all across the country. I'm in California, so it's nice and hot here. I don't know. I know Gus is in Washington. Where are you, Bob? You're in the East, right?
Olympia, Washington.
Oh, that's right. Okay. I don't know why I always think you're East, too. Almost everybody's on the East Coast except me.
So am I the closest to Lafayette out of the group? I'm only like an hour away.
Yeah, I don't know if we have Indiana people here yet. I'm not sure where Steve and Jonathan. I think Steve somewhere is the East.
Yeah, I'm in North Carolina.
Oh, that's awesome. Yeah, you got the little twang.
Can't you hear the southern twang?
That's what I was saying. Twang. I'm pretty sure you're from the South. You may not still be there, but
yeah. Anything
so incredible, Arizona. This is awesome.
Krispy Kreme donuts. That's us.
I see. Well, that's good to be famous for something, huh? Yeah, we have Gus out on the West Coast with me as well. So, and there's Donald.
I'm looking at the chat. I think I'm the closest to Lafayette out of everybody here. That's great.
we just pretend to be from there. I've visited a few times. It gives me anywhere. We haven't been in a long time thanks to the COVID, but we went there several times early on. Beautiful campus there, in West Lafayette, and our office is now in West Lafayette. You know, we have an office in Indianapolis that has been shut down. We also have an office in Chicago that's been shut down. And kind of good thing, I guess, because we all kind of centralize now in West Lafayette.
So full disclosure, I'm an IU grad, so hopefully that doesn't mean we have to end the webinar now because of that. But hopefully you'll forgive me and you'll be kind anyway.
Yes. Just, you know, a little competition is fine. You'll see a lot of the students. And Donald is our faculty sponsor here, by the way. He's the cyber faculty sponsor who also leads the student teams. But we compete with IU and other Indiana universities in all the competitions. So that's where, you know, Indiana Tech comes into play and Vincennes and Ivy Tech. We do a lot of competitions where we cross over with them. So keep it in Indiana.
Yeah.
All right. So we have started the recording. So I'm going to go ahead and let us get started, and then students can join and watch the recording if they've missed. But why don't you go ahead and tell us all about yourself, Benjamin, and share where you work and how you got there and all that good stuff.
Sure. Happy to. So good evening, everyone. Thank you for the opportunity to talk with you this evening. Like I said, I'm an IU grad, but that's okay. We're all friends here. I think this will be a good conversation. But started my career at Ernst & Young in Chicago. So I did some consulting for a couple of years. From there, I moved over to CNA Insurance, also in Chicago. So there was a red building that if you see the Chicago skyline, you always see this red building right off the lake there. That's CNA. And I think they've actually moved since then, but I used to work there for 3 years. And then from there, I finally came down to what used to be called Conseco. Now it's called CNO Financial Group. Started leading security there about 8 years ago. I recently obtained the title Chief Information Security Officer about 3 years ago. So I was leading it without the title, and then I got the title. So that was helpful. And really have built the cybersecurity program from the ground up. So we were relatively what I would call underfunded 6 or 7 years ago. And then Anthem happened, the Anthem breach, and that of course was a game changer for us. So we very quickly got a lot of board level attention. The board of the company, the executive leaders of the organization also realized that cybersecurity was a material business risk to the organization. And so consequently, you know, for the good, I guess, the funding quickly followed. And I was able to quickly build up a program being people resources, technology, you know, using consulting and managed service providers. You know, all those sorts of things that really go into making a strong cybersecurity program. So the key aspect of really the beginnings of building that program was hiring talent. And that's where I think all of you come in, especially the students. I think there's something in the neighborhood of 1.5 million global cybersecurity jobs that are unfilled. I myself have 4 of those currently, which tells you there is a need for this type of skill. Back when I was at IU, they did not have a cybersecurity or information security program. I was a CIS or MIS major in the Kelly School of Business. And I see Dean's here. Hi, Dean. Nice to see you. Dean's my guy, by the way. So I think he kind of shepherded all this to happen tonight. But I did not have a cybersecurity program at IU. And I really am thrilled for the students to have this opportunity to get some background and get some theory in this discipline prior to going into the workforce. And again, you know, you will have no trouble getting a job if you choose to pursue a career in cybersecurity. That is for sure. One of the things I like to tell students when I talk to them or people that are new into the workforce who have an interest in cybersecurity is, you know, we all recognize and understand that when you go through college, you do projects, you work with groups, you get an understanding, a basic understanding, you get theory essentially. No hands-on experience. You have some other employment experiences as you go through college and so forth. You know, one of the things I look for as a leader in cybersecurity is what I will call technical curiosity. So I like to hear from students who, you know, I say, what do you do in your free time? When I'm interviewing them or talking with them, and they say, you know, I do some singing, I do music, I do this, that. And I also, by the way, set up a web server in my apartment at home. Oh, okay. So tell me more about that. You know, I have people say, you know, I just installed a Linux server on a device that I had and started playing around with that. And that's what I call technical curiosity. And that's what I look for, because I'm aware you guys don't have that type of experience under your belt at this point in time. But I think you will turn a lot of heads if you can demonstrate that you are someone who's self-motivated, someone who has an interest in technology in particular, especially cybersecurity, self-taught, those sorts of things. That's what's really going to attract, I think, the employers that want to look at college graduates, new members in the workforce and that sort of thing. So, you know, I always like to say that to a group like this. Really enjoy the energy and excitement for students and folks that do come out of college, even if it's Purdue. That's fine too. But you know, think about doing that as you go through your college career. Think about what you do with your free time and how that would demonstrate to a potential employer, you know, your level of interest, your excitement around technology, around cybersecurity, around hitting the workforce running, if you will. So that's me in a nutshell. Like I said, Dean Diltz works for me at CNO. I have a team of about 37 people currently at CNO, which is actually quite a large team for a company our size. And again, that's because we have a very risk-aware leadership of the company, I would say. But I would also say that we employ a diverse operating model as well. So not only do we leverage internal staff like Dean, for example, but we also leverage managed service providers. So we buy black box services, if you will, especially around like security operations, things of that nature. And also skilled contracting consulting expertise as well. So it's kind of this three-legged stool of how we operate and how we kind of diversify our operating model from a resourcing perspective. Really helps kind of federate the risk. So if I, you know, have trouble hiring in the internal side, then I can rely on contracting or consulting resources. I can rely on managed service providers, things of that nature. So it's worked very well for us. And like I said, it's a blessing to be able to be so well resourced at CNO like we are. So that's a little bit about me.
Good, good. So have you considered apprenticeships? Do you do that at all?
You know, it's interesting. We definitely do internships. We have a very robust, I would say, internship program. It's actually very well run because students actually get not only cybersecurity experience, but they get to experience other aspects of the IT department, whether it be, you know, data science, it could be infrastructure services, those sorts of things. And then we recently started a program called Hiring Our Heroes, which is employing resources directly out of the military. And those looking for a job, they've recently left military service and have an interest in technology, have an interest in cybersecurity. It's kind of run like an internship program where they have 12 weeks to work with us and really get a good understanding of what it is we do and kind of determine whether a career in cybersecurity is what they want to do. So that sort of thing. But we're, you know, I would say this, I am a huge fan of motivated students. I'm always willing to have conversations with any student that would like to do that. You know, pick my brain, set up a one-to-one meeting. Email's fine as well. I love those sorts of interactions. I had some mentors back when I was at IU that really kind of propelled me into my career. And so I love doing that sort of thing with students and young people entering the workforce. So.
Yeah. So does it help at all, or does it matter if they have a finance background at all?
Oh gosh, no. In fact, you know, it's interesting. We have a resource on my team that does nothing but the financial aspect of running our cyber program. And so kind of gets the best of both worlds, right? So they get to manage budget, forecasting, signing contracts and SOWs, those sorts of things, as well as doing the project management and kind of that, the business of cybersecurity, if you will. So there's really opportunities for everyone. And by the way, I think there's also a lot of benefit in diverse thinking and backgrounds as well. As you work in a career in cybersecurity or at a company like CNO, I've noticed over the years that, we've hired various types of people and backgrounds, and they've all added a flavor to what it is we do. And so I'm a huge fan of people coming out of school with business degrees and finance degrees, all sorts of different things. And I could go on and on. CompSci we've hired, but it just really fosters an environment of diverse thinking, which I think is so helpful, especially when we live in a climate in which we do in terms of cyber risk. The cyber risk meter is off the charts currently, and we need people that think out of the box, that think from a diverse viewpoint to help us with that.
May I ask a question? This is Laurent Bouquet speaking. Thank you for accepting Dr. Bertrand's invitation. The question I would ask you is, what certs do you think are the most important to help someone show that they have the experience and knowledge to get into cybersecurity?
What was the first part of your question? I didn't catch the first part.
So what certifications do you think are the most important to show that you have the experience?
I'm a huge fan of certifications, cyber certifications, that is. Dean can attest, we are hugely supportive, both from a financial perspective, allowing for the time to study for those sorts of things. One thing to keep in mind is that certification, you can really sit for the examinations anytime you want, for the most part, across some of the highly coveted certifications, but you do have to have X amount of years experience. The preeminent certification, of course, is the CISSP, Certified Information Security Systems Professional. But then there's also the CISA, Certified Information Security Auditor, CISM. There's a whole bunch, Security Plus. But I would truly recommend that someone definitely prioritize it at some point in their career. Getting a certification demonstrates competency. It's very interesting. It's actually been a topic during board meetings. So when I go before the board and I present cybersecurity to the board of the company, and they're asking various questions, it's really very helpful to be able for me to be able to demonstrate the competency of the team by saying I have 13 CISSPs on staff. I have 17 Security Plus certified resources on staff. They love that sort of thing. That tells them we're hiring the right resources, the ones that are motivated to get those certifications, and that we know what we're doing. So I'm a huge fan, very supportive.
What about CCNA? What do you think of CCNA? I tell my students, I teach CISSP myself. I tell them that if they come in with a CCNA, some kind of Cisco cert plus a Microsoft cert,
you read my mind. I was about to say Microsoft too, because Microsoft is embedded within every organization. But yes, those are critical as well. Those are especially needed for resources that do hands on keyboard, that really manage and run the technology to optimize it for security. Those are the people that really know what they're doing. They talk circles around my head when we talk technical, when we talk about, networking technologies, when we talk about operating systems, user directories, various things like that. Microsoft is enormous right now. I could, because we're all aware, Just about every company runs some flavor of Windows, whether it be on the endpoint or whether it be the operating system. Most companies run their email in O365 now in the cloud. We leverage many, many other technologies at CNO from Microsoft. So it makes it especially important that we secure those technologies in particular, because we have immense amounts of business data stored in Microsoft's cloud, and it's only getting more, you know, as we go here. So those are absolutely critical as well. And again, I think there's no limit in terms of the amount of certifications you can get or the type. You know, I would just say sometimes it's kind of an onerous thing to study for those certifications, take the classes and so forth. So you might want to spread those out. But I think when you're going out into the workforce, I would ask that question of an employer when you're interviewing or when you're determining whether you want a career in cyber. You could say, do you support getting certified? Do you support sitting for those examinations? Not only that, what's your training budget look like? Do you support ensuring that you get continuing professional education if I'm employed here? Those are key questions, because the place you don't want to be is with an organization or with a career that doesn't support growth. You always want to be growing. You never want to be standing still and stagnant. You always want to be looking at that next step. And that's the way to do it, through training, through growth opportunities, through networking, getting certified, taking those trainings that are prevalent and offered, you know, across the industry.
What are your thoughts on the AWS certifications?
Say that one more time. I didn't catch it. Sorry.
Amazon Web Certifications.
I mean, I would say it's about the same thing as getting certified in Microsoft or Cisco or Oracle. All these technologies, you know, companies right now are migrating to the cloud faster than you can blink an eye. Of course, Amazon Web Services is one of those cloud providers that is on fire, just like Microsoft. Google, of course, is another one. So, yeah, of course, if you desire a career in hands-on and technology, maybe you don't see yourself going on like a management track, for example. You really want to be embedded with the technology. You want to be viewed as a technological expert. Then, yeah, of course, you want to get those certifications. Now, you know, there's an argument to be made whether you specialize in a particular platform like AWS or Microsoft. Which is fine. I mean, there's no shortage in careers and jobs from that perspective. Or the other side of the argument is, do you become a jack of all trades, master of none, and really kind of understand the concepts behind those cloud providers? You know enough to be dangerous. Perhaps you want to be in the management track. But again, that's totally up to you. If you view yourself as someone who loves technology, who understands cloud services, who understands cloud security and those types of concepts, absolutely go for it if that's what you want to do. But then again, there's careers for people who want to just understand how do you secure basic cloud services like O365, like Google. There's careers there as well.
So I apologize for going back into this, but certification are a huge part of what we're doing. So if you had to prioritize for technical people, what do you think would be the most important for technical people, most important cert?
Yeah, it's a good question. I would say it depends on what you want to do, ultimately. There is no question that cybersecurity is a hot field. There's no question that data science is a hot field. Cloud security, of course, or cloud in general is a hot field. So it really depends on what you do, where you lean, of course. You can't go wrong if you choose to go down a path in one of those disciplines, because they're not going away anytime soon. You can get certified in any number of those things. You know, you could get certified in multiple things. You could become an expert at AWS security, so you're even specializing even further, even more granularly. So for technical students, it really depends on where your interest lies. You know, there's so many opportunities out there today. You know, the market is on fire. So many jobs available to students who really, again, goes back to showing that technical curiosity, that interest level in growing in a career in technology. So it really depends on your lean, your likings, those sorts of things.
Cool. So just one question also. I see that you guys have a bunch of companies, really. I mean, your Bankers Life, your Colonial Penn, Direct Pass, Washington National. How difficult is it as a CISO to manage the security posture of different companies integrated as one, pretty much? I mean, how difficult was it for you to do that?
It's a fantastic question. And the reason that's a great question is because those business units that you just described, they all have different operating models. They all have different distribution of our insurance products. So for example, Colonial Penn is direct to consumer. So they interact with the consumer directly. They have call centers to support, our parents calling them up and getting their insurance policy serviced. You probably have seen Colonial Penn commercials, the Alex Trebek and so forth. He's not obviously no longer doing that, but so that's Colonial Penn. So that has a whole set of challenges associated with it. When you're interacting with customers directly, they're going to our websites. You have to have web security. You have to have proper authentication. It's a bit of a balancing act because you have to layer on risk-based authentication. You have to layer on multi-factor authentication, but our customer base tends to be slightly older people who are thinking about retirement, thinking about insurance products to get them to that retirement age. So, they may not be as technically savvy. So that's a balance. Then we have Bankers Life, and Bankers Life is more of what I'll call a traditional insurance operating model, which is we have almost 6,000 insurance agents that literally go into people's homes and sell insurance across the kitchen table. We still do that. We have a rural market that's lucrative for us. So we have agents who go out into farm territories in the United States and they sit across from the kitchen table and sell that way. So of course that has its own sets of challenges. There's basic tenets that we have to follow across the board. We have to deliver our products and services in a way that that people can trust or they won't do business with us. So it's very interesting, the parallel that I see with the business line that we're in insurance. It's all built on trust. People trust that in their time of need, we will provide the products and services that they've entered into with us. Very similarly, cybersecurity is built on trust. People want to know that their data that we hold and that they've entrusted us with, that we take that very seriously, and we consider all aspects of securing that data. Not disclosing it to unauthorized parties, making sure that we are regulatorily compliant with how we manage that data. It's all built around trust. There's basic tenets. There's things you do by course. You do strong authentication, as an example. You do data encryption as part of your kind of good hygiene of running a cybersecurity program for an insurance company. You do vulnerability management. You do security operations, which is like the 24/7 monitoring of the activity that goes on within our systems, network, and so forth to ensure that the bad guys haven't gotten in and are doing bad things. There's control frameworks out there, like NIST Cybersecurity Control Framework, that kind of make that roadmap or that, framework, for lack of a better term, easy to understand and digest and understand what you're supposed to have as part of normal hygiene to run a program. And we follow that. But again, there's also things that we have to consider for the various business units and how they distribute our products and various models that they have. It's very interesting. And that was a great question.
What are your thoughts on this 853 405?
Say that one more time. I apologize.
Do you have any thoughts on NIST 853, Rev 4, and Rev 5?
Yeah. So if I heard the question correctly, do we use NIST 800.53? So between that and NIST Cybersecurity Framework, that's the more prescriptive of the two frameworks. So we follow components of 53, but primarily the NIST Cybersecurity Framework is a higher level version of that. And that's kind of what we align our control structures to. What it does is it gives us flexibility to implement the proper controls the way our business needs, sort of dictate that without being terribly prescriptive, like 800.53, or you talk about ISO, different standards like that. They're very prescriptive. You got regulatory frameworks, like PCI and things like that. They're very prescriptive. But the NIST cybersecurity framework is higher level than that. And again, gives us that flexibility to implement the types of controls that really, support our business and what we feel is appropriate for our business model, business objectives, goals, and so forth.
Fantastic. What are your thoughts on cyber intelligence?
That's a good question. So, this is one of my favorite topics because I think it's one of those things that I'm very proud of that we've implemented at CNO since my time. I'll give you an overview of our SOC, our Security Operations Center. So again, the SOC is the 24/7 group that monitors our systems and network for malicious activity. It can detect things like malware on endpoints. It can detect things like intrusion, unauthorized use of credentials. I could go on and on, but that's that group, right? As part of that, there's a subcomponent of the SOC that manages threat intelligence. And we have, oodles and oodles of inputs from a threat intelligence perspective. So clearly there are paid threat intelligence providers that we subscribe to and give us very robust threat intelligence data that we can use with high confidence because they've vetted things on their side, whether it be IP addresses, email addresses, so on and so forth, those sorts of things. So we have a number of paid feeds, if you will, that actually get ingested by our threat intelligence platform that automatically apply then those controls to our firewalls and endpoints and so forth. We have industry trade groups like FSISAC, which provides us member-provided threat intelligence feeds. So, for example, if a financial services firm like Chase or Allstate, for example, they're members of this consortium that we are as well. We provide each other what we're seeing in the wild in terms of threat intelligence that, again, get ingested real time into our systems to proactively block those things, detect those things, and so forth. And then there's just a number of partners that we leverage as well. So within our information technology department as a whole, we have two very, very large managed service partners that we have contracted with to essentially run large components of our IT department. They're very good because they have other clients that they're doing cybersecurity for as well. So we can leverage that. We can say, you are providing us with a service. What are you seeing in the wild? What are you seeing from your other clients? And they provide us, a lot of data, a lot of threat intelligence metrics and so forth that we leverage as part of our process. We have very robust technology systems that we use in our SOC. So for example, we use a tool called Splunk Enterprise Security, which is a very, industry leading, very strong log aggregation and correlation tool. So many, many, many of our logs are aggregated to this one source. And then you layer on then the threat intelligence that you're referring to. And we're able to see in real time or near real time whether or not we're seeing any of those bad IP addresses, whether or not we're seeing real-time attacks that are emanating from overseas and so forth in that environment. So very, very handy from that perspective.
So thank you for your answer. Two questions based on what you just said. You mentioned countries. I mean, do you see the usual Russia, China, and so forth as the big countries trying to commit financial fraud?
You're gonna get me fired up because this is a topic I love talking about. CNO, the way I would start to answer that question is we are, I guess, very fortunate. It's kind of an odd way to look at it that we're not a global company. We're really just a national company. We do business in the United States. We have some IT providers over in India. So that's a good thing for us from a cyber perspective because what I'm able to do now is all out block those countries that are known for those types of attacks that you're referring to. So I can block those countries at the firewall, at the load balancer, on our endpoints, in Microsoft O365 and other cloud services. I can all out say, do not allow any traffic to come into CNO from Russia, from China, from North Korea. That's a key control of ours, and it works very well. Now, we all know IP addresses change in 30 seconds, in a minute, as quickly as you can blink an eye. but that's where we get those, we pay those providers to constantly keep those databases of bad IPs up to date, right? We absolutely see attacks from Russia, China, the countries you would think those attacks would be coming from. We absolutely, and it's mostly automated, by the way. So just today, there's probably been over 100,000 types of automated attacks emanating from those places within the world. Not unusual. Now, of course, we have defenses that knock those things down, you know, 99 or hopefully 100% of the time. We all know nothing's foolproof in this industry, but you know, it's a common thing to see that. It really goes back to, you know, what I keep referring to as good cyber hygiene. You really cannot rely on one, or there's no magic bullet that's going to stop everything. You have to have a layered security environment that has controls at every layer that you can possibly have. External controls that block things that don't belong, right? Strong authentication, then you go down and you have operating system controls, patch management processes, vulnerability management that scan our systems for vulnerabilities before the bad guys can find those things. But it is absolutely out of control in terms of organized crime emanating from overseas. We're seeing that now. The one thing that keeps me awake at night is ransomware. And if you guys aren't familiar with that term, that is where there's malware that encrypts data and then demand a ransom to unencrypt that data. So they're really trying to make money off of that. By and large, 90% of that emanates from overseas and organized crime groups. It's so bad that they have networks of contractors to handle each stage of the attack before the malware is dropped. So for example, they hire a contractor that says, you know, for this rate, once we get paid, you know, you're going to be the guy that gets us in the front door, that finds the vulnerability, that lets them into CNO. Then they go down to the next layer. They hire the contractor, if you will, for lack of a better term, that once you're in now, they scope the environment and look for ways to elevate their privileges and find the things that they're looking for. And then finally, they have a third contractor that comes in and deploys the ransomware, the malware, into the environment. And they all kind of specialize. But that's how organized it is these days. Not only that, these attackers, they have help desks for when a company like CNO has a ransomware issue and their files are encrypted and they need help with the decryption key. You can call them and they're very friendly. They said, oh, hi, Mr. Tesner, we'll help you decrypt your files. And it's amazing. I mean, this all is very organized and lucrative. I think the most recent ransomware attack that was so prevalent in the news was from a software provider over in Europe named Kaseya, and the ransom demand that they faced was the highest ever recorded, $70 million. CNA Insurance, who was, you know, that's my previous employer. They also had a ransomware issue very recently, earlier this year. That ransom demand was $40 million. So there's a reason why these ransom demands are so high. It's because they work. So that's a long way of answering your question. But like I said, it gets me fired up. But we absolutely see attacks from overseas every day.
Excellent. Yeah, I keep telling my students that statistics show that 60% of malicious activity comes from China right now on non government networks, which
I believe it.
Really, yeah, interesting to see that, you know, China is for the most part the bad guy. That's the statistic as of right now.
Totally agree. That kind of aligns with what we see as well. But again, I mean, you really see the typical people you would think: China, Russia, North Korea, the Middle East, those sorts of things. Those we see the most malicious activity emanating from there. I see Dean in the chat too, by the way, talks about making it illegal to pay the ransom. That's already here. That's already here. So there's the OFAC regulation that says essentially, you know, they have a list of known attack groups in the OFAC list, and they essentially say, if you pay these groups, you're supporting terrorism. And so that's a regulation, that's a federal regulation, and you will get steep penalties from the federal government if you do that. Now, people have gotten creative So there's an attack group called R-Evil that does a lot of ransomware attacks. They're from primarily Russia, it's believed. They launched an attack, and I'll leave the company's name anonymous, but everyone knew the markers were from R-Evil, that group. But the company creatively called it by the name of the ransomware variant that was deployed instead of the name of the group. So that kind of got them around the OFAC, regulation. Then there's other companies that I'm aware of that say, sorry, I got a business to run. I'll get a slap on the wrist from the federal government with the OFAC thing here. I've got to get my files decrypted. I'll pay you the ransom. And then worry about the other stuff later. So there's various schools of thought. Now, I will say CNO's stance, if we were ever to have a ransomware issue, which we haven't, thank goodness, is to not pay the attackers. And there's a number of reasons for that. One is because they have networks where they talk. And so they'll say, we got CNO to pay. You know, they're an easy target. They're going to pay some more. And it also just it encourages the business, and we don't want to be a part of that. We don't want to be viewed as perpetuating a bad situation. So now you may say, okay, well, you say you're not going to pay. What do you do when all your files and systems are encrypted? And the answer is you have to rely on your backups. Backups are a critical cyber control that not a lot of people think of at times. So not only do you have to have reliable backups, you have to test those. Can you recover from your backups? That's a huge piece of being able to provide some assurance to your stakeholders that you could recover from a ransomware attack. Not only that, the way the ransomware attacks are going these days, the malicious attack groups get a foothold on your network, and as part of their, you know, procedures, if you will, for lack of a better term, their playbook, they look for your backups to try to either destroy them, encrypt them, otherwise harm the integrity of those backups, so that you're really left with no other option than to pay the ransom. So what you want to do there is you want to take very deliberate steps to secure your backups through a number of means. It's very interesting that nowadays, you know, we used to have these huge tape robots. Tape is backup media. It's actually literally these cassettes, these big tapes that we used to have. And these robots would mount the tapes. You'd write to the tapes. Then the robot would unmount the tapes. And essentially, that's called what we refer to as an air gap solution. There's no way that those tapes could be compromised by a breach or a hacker that's gotten into your network, because they're not physically connected, you know, during normal course of business. And so we've obviously moved away from that, because now you have cloud, which is so easy to then, you know, send your backups to the cloud, unlimited storage. You don't have to worry about that with cloud, but that's not air gapped. There's logical linkages between your environment and the cloud. And if you have a malicious attacker on the inside, they're going to go for that. So now it's interesting. It's almost like we've come full circle, because now people are recommending you have air gapped backups again, so that you preserve the integrity of your backups. So we're not going to bring our robots back in, of course, and go back to tape, because that was a nightmare to recover from to begin with. But we're having to think creatively on how we preserve the integrity of our backups, you know, knowing that the attackers are entering the environment trying to compromise those things so they can deploy the malware, and then we're left with no other choice than to pay the ransom.
You have a very good point. I mean, I was working for a fairly large financial organization, and we had the backups at an offsite location. And one day I said, well, we should test to see if it works. Fortunately, we backed up everything on drive, so we had multiple backups. And when we tried to restore from the tapes, it didn't work. So we had been paying for 7 years, something like that, for tapes, and it would have never worked.
So, yeah, I totally agree. In fact, I just read an article where companies have taken great care of preserving their backups, but then once they're actually in a situation where they have to restore and they say go, then the Microsoft window pops up that says, you know, this process will take 8 years. And they're like, okay, so now I have good backups, but I still can't recover because of how long it would take to recover. So then they're paying the ransom anyway, even with good backups. So point is, it's so important to test. You really have to have a firm understanding with your recovery strategy, and ensuring that you have proper controls built around preserving those backups, because it's a key cyber control nowadays.
And be careful with how you store your media. I was talking recently with a company that had still some data on zip drives. I mean, you know, I mean, I don't know if you remember zip drives from the 90s, but, you know, try to do anything with, they were saying, well, you know, it's safe, it's over there. But, yeah. You know, would you be able to mount a zip drive easily? I don't know. So anyway, yeah. You mentioned several things, again, that were very interesting. What are your thoughts on InfraGuard? And then what are your thoughts on honeypots?
So did you say, what are my thoughts on InfraGuard?
InfraGuard, yes. FBI?
We've participated in InfraGuard, but it's not, you know, one of our main relationships. So we exchange threat intelligence with InfraGuard and the FBI just to help others and to also kind of receive that back. But we don't have a huge relationship with InfraGuard. I will say, you know, we unlike, you know, most organizations have had incidents where we've had to involve the FBI. And what we've noticed with having to work with the FBI is they're very willing to take our threat intelligence and our information, but they're not as willing to give it back. So we're less motivated because of that, right?
They actually have programs where you can have a classified facility in your facility and then get what you're talking about. So mm-hmm. It's feasible. It's not easy, but it's doable. Just FYI.
Yeah. And we get a lot of what you're talking about through our consortiums like FSISAC as well, and that's it's a little more applicable, if you will, than InfraGuard. InfraGuard is generic across all industries, of course, but FSISAC is specific to the financial services industry. So we can relate to other financial services firms in a very confidential manner, and it's more applicable to our business model and the sorts of attacks we would see because we hold money and things, and of course that's what they want. So we participate much more heavily in that type of thing than we do, you know, InfraGuard and some of the other things. Now, there is obviously value in all of those things. I think the key to any of this, of course, is information sharing and being very open and transparent about what transpires in your environment on a daily basis, and we try to do that. But there's a lot of opportunity to do that. And again, we like the consortiums that relate more to financial services. You know, that's just our preference.
So what are your thoughts on honeypots?
Thoughts on what?
Honeypots.
Honeypots. Well, you know, I'm a fan. It's not a technology that we've employed yet at CNO. There's a lot of solutions out there to do that sort of thing. It's better to have a honeypot in your environment where you're actually seeing, you know, that technology being attacked as opposed to your regular systems. It can certainly glean valuable data, you know, by putting those in strategic places within your network, whether it be at your border or whether it be, you know, deep inside, and then you start seeing unusual activity. Of course, what you'd expect to see with a honeypot is nothing. That's what you'd hope anyway. Meaning, you know, it's kind of enticing, but no one's biting because there's no one in your environment. But it's one of many strategies to, you know, have visibility into what's going on in your network. I feel like we have at CNO great visibility into what goes on because we leverage robust logs in our actual systems, and those sorts of things. So it just depends. I mean, I think it works. I think it's a good nice to have. I'm not sure it's critical to have in a cyber program, but you know, there's not unlimited dollars, you know, in organizations these days. So that's not something we've chosen to invest in yet. Now we may choose to do that, but you know, that's not something we've done yet.
Another question that I have for you is, I started personally. I mean, like you, I work for Coopers. I mean, you work Ernst & Young, but I was at Coopers and Librant when back then. Would it make sense to have a set of controls similar to the things that they have in accounting to provide investors with a level of confidence that companies have an adequate level of security? Do you think that such system could be valuable for investors to know that the companies the investment is safe.
Yeah, so I actually think that already exists. So there's, you know, obviously one being a regulated entity like we are, we do have investment brokers as well. So they help you with your investments and your portfolio and the whole thing. That's heavily regulated by the SEC and by a regulatory body called FINRA. And if you ask me what that stands for, I don't know, because that's more on the finance side. But they absolutely are in our house looking at our controls on a regular basis. And then we have to attest to those controls as well, so that we say we have met minimum standards to house this data, to work in the financial sector, work on Wall Street, do that sort of thing. So a lot of that already exists. Now, I wouldn't say necessarily that they have their own framework that they say, here, you have to implement this framework and you can do business in Wall Street. But they absolutely have auditors and assessors that, you know, look at our controls on a regular basis for sure.
Wonderful.
Yeah. And I saw, looks like somebody said Colonial Pipeline was the company. So I don't know if you're referring to. So we have a company called Colonial Penn as one of our insurance units. So I didn't want to confuse that, because, of course, Colonial Pipeline had its own set of issues recently as well, which is interesting too. You know, I have a personal perspective that, yeah, and I see Dean mentioned SOC 1 and SOC 2 as another means to attest to your controls. I happen to have a personal opinion that, you know, when the day comes, unfortunately, when our critical infrastructure is impacted and you start facing loss of life even, or loss of critical services, then data breaches are going to be looked at as small potatoes. Haven't got there yet, fortunately, but, you know, I would have to say with the way things are trending, you know, with cyber warfare between nation states increasing, that will be coming. And then I think people are going to forget about data breaches, because they won't care about data. They're going to care about human life. They're going to care about critical services that keep our country running. And I guess you could say I'm pessimistic or realist, but I think that day is coming.
And to that point, I was at DEF CON last week, and I've gone a few times. And I remember as early as 2015, there was a village about medical hacking, and they were showing how people will be blackmailed that have pacemakers or any kind of electronics, and it will be pay or you die.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, we obviously don't have a lot of IoT. We don't have any IoT, but everything's connected to the internet now. Everything has a vulnerability. Everything that's connected to the internet has a vulnerability. There are people working 24/7 to find those vulnerabilities. And then there are people like us who have to defend that. And we don't have as many resources as they have to actually do what they're doing. They do that as part of their business. So anyway, I see Andres in the chat here. Yeah, critical infrastructure, huge attack surface, and probably, unfortunately, not only is it a huge attack surface, it's probably historically been underinvested in from a cyber perspective. So they've spent a lot of money to build up the infrastructure itself, but they probably haven't, you know, I guess invested or kept pace with needing to secure that. I think hopefully they're doing it now, you know, but things supported by the government probably aren't. It's terribly well-funded and well-resourced. As the private sector might be. So again, I try not to be pessimistic. I view it as being more of a realist, but that to me is the next major thing you'll read about. People are numb reading about data breaches nowadays. They're numb reading in the newspaper about ransomware. It happens more than you think. Sometimes it's in the media, sometimes it's not. But people will start paying attention when our livelihoods are affected. And I think that's how wars are going to be fought. And now, you know, into the future, it's going to be all about securing that critical infrastructure, ensuring our safety as a nation from that perspective.
I agree. 100%. I mean, I'm actually shocked that nothing has happened so far, because it would be so easy to destroy all of the infrastructure with industrial control systems. We had... last year, we had the CEO of Dragos come to speak to the students. And, you know, there was Chris Roberts. Chris Roberts refuses to drive a car with any electronics because he's afraid that if something happens, he could not drive his car. And I can understand it. I mean, you know, the probably one of the companies that is going to be hit big time is going to be Tesla. All of the cars that have all of these automated systems for driving, they will be shut down remotely. And there will be huge loss of life.
I totally agree. It's already been said, but, you know, anything connected to the internet represents an attack surface. And that's only increasing. So hopefully I'm wrong. I want to be wrong, but we never know.
So there was a few questions. Do you think the government should do more to protect companies? Okay, I think you answered that one.
So that's a tough question to answer. Sometimes what I've noticed, and I'm just speaking from experience, this isn't an opinion by any means, is overregulation around this particular area, cybersecurity or data security, has led to us making decisions as an organization for the sake of compliance. And that's not a great thing to do, in my opinion. I think we have to do the right thing for our stakeholders, our customers, our agents, our employees. Doing things for the sake of compliance only is a waste of resources and diverts attention away from other critical things. We talked about the fact that there's not unlimited resources available. So what I think needs to happen more than regulation is what we've talked about around threat sharing, setting up a network of open collaboration around companies like ours, both in the public, private sector, as well as government. I think that's critical. I think frameworks are critical so that we all are doing the right things, the baselines, the things that we need to do as just basics. But, you know, again, I will say, you know, regulation and the government stepping in just for the, and then having to align to various, compliance mandates, if you will, that tends to be distracting and really takes our focus away from the things that we actually need to do to secure our environment. That's my opinion.
I agree. I mean, in my regular job, one of my challenges is that we have to comply with mandates, and we do things just because it's required, regardless of if it makes sense. And we spend so much time and money doing and redoing paperwork that it's just paperwork. I mean, it's the only value is being a paperweight. That's it. It has no value. It's sad.
To be fair, there are a number of regulations or compliance requirements that make sense. So, for example, PCI is the compliance mandate for credit card data. They've got a lot of smart things in there and a lot of things that make sense if you want to possess that data. Then there's just things that don't add value anymore, such as Sarbanes-Oxley. That has run its course, in my opinion. The things you do for Sarbanes is we've moved past that. Now that's basic stuff that every company already has, and it's costly to have all those external audits completed on an annual basis. So anyway, I go both ways, like I said, but it's a good debate.
Okay. There were some questions about critical infrastructure. I think we talked about that. Am I missing any questions, Tina?
I see a question in there about insider threat. We have a robust insider threat program at CINO. So an insider threat is an attack from a trusted source. And that could be everything from somebody actually trying to exfiltrate data, whether it be to take client lists to their next place of employment. They know they're leaving the company. But it could be as small as just misuse of a corporate asset like a laptop and browsing inappropriate sites, doing gambling on those things. That is all under the umbrella of an insider threat. And it goes back to the security operations center monitoring for that sort of thing, having very, like I said, robust response activities associated with that in concert with our HR department, our special investigations unit, and those sorts of things. So yeah, insider threat is something we're very keen on. It happens more than you think. Sometimes it's innocent, sometimes it's not, but it happens more than you think.
Nice. Cool.
Jacqueline was asking, do you think the government should get involved when companies are attacked by ransomware?
Yes, I do, actually. I think the FBI provide some of the, authority. They provide, they're the authorities that respond and help with this sort of thing. So, for example, CNO had a data security incident 3 years back. It was bigger in magnitude. I wouldn't say it was, huge or the end of the world by any means, but it's something we had to respond to. We got the FBI involved because of the needs there and involving the authorities and the legal aspects of doing that. And they apprehended some of the actual perpetrators of that crime. Now, some they didn't, but they were able to bring some of those perpetrators to justice. So from that perspective, of course, they help. And again, it goes back to threat sharing or incident sharing in this case. And we became aware when we had that particular incident that 9 other companies had been attacked by the same group. And the only way we became aware of that was because we all involved the FBI, we all involved the federal government. And so we were able to learn quite a bit about the adversary because of that. So there's utility to getting the government involved. Again, if they overstep from a regulatory perspective, that's painful. But there's pros and cons to both, I would say.
Great chat. So I only have a couple minutes left, but I wanted to ask my own question. We're interested in putting together a program in fintech, which is kind of my new buzzword.
Yeah.
Don't know what that really is, other than technology and finance kind of thing. But what would that look like if you had a fintech program? I'm understanding it to be more technical than finance, but clearly You have to have an understanding of finance, right, for financial systems.
Yeah, I mean, so we work with fintech companies. They're essentially these small startup companies in most cases that are able to stand up in a very agile way, new technology to say, hey, why don't you try this? Mm-hmm. And we're able to, projects tend to have long tails when you're an organization, especially one that's heavily regulated. You got to do all sorts of different things around implementation, change management, and so forth. But these fintech companies are able just to very quickly stand up technology that could be useful to support our business. And we're able to tell very quickly whether that technology is useful or not. So we give them feedback and they help us, with various aspects of our business, whether it be small, large, and how technology could possibly support that. So I'm a fan. From a security perspective, you got to be careful because a lot of the times with these fintech companies, they say, let's do a proof of concept. So why don't you give us some of your business data and allow us to run it through our system. We'll show you the value. I say, okay. But in the meantime, I'm going to need to see all of your security controls you have in your environment because you're wanting me to share my data. That's not something we take lightly. That's something that's it has to be a very well controlled process. So now that slows down fintech a little bit to some degree, but there's a balance you can strike. And we've been very successful with fintech companies. In fact, the company that I think Laurent mentioned earlier that we've acquired 2 years back, Web Benefits Design, that was a fintech company. So we actually acquired one of those companies and integrated that into our environment because their technology was so useful to CNO and our business model that was a helpful thing. There's fintech companies that do security. There's fintech companies that do nothing but insurance technologies, across the board. So yeah, I'm a fan.
Ah, interesting. Yeah. It's just another area that we're thinking because, I'm in the School of IT, but we're part of the School of Business and IT, and we have a finance department, and we're just thinking of putting together something that combines the two. So would an example be kind of like Rocket Mortgage that has their little app and everything that you hear about on TV all the time?
No, I would say probably not. I would just say fintech tends to be very tactical, functional solutions for organizations like Rocket Mortgage, right?
Okay.
Rocket Mortgage is more of a business, more of a holistic solution. Fintech tends to want to come in and solve a very finite problem for you with technology and do it very quickly. So a lot of that happens behind the scenes, right? A lot of that happens actually working directly with our business owners, not IT even. These fintech companies that sell their thought or their concept to our business owners, and those people tend to say, yeah, it doesn't make sense for us, or wow, there might be some legs there that helps us gain a competitive edge from a business perspective, right? So that's the way I would look at that.
So a lot on the application development side then.
It could be, sure. Yeah, it could be application development. It could be a cloud-based solution. It could be a mobile solution. Okay. You know, it could be components of those things, very small solutions. It could be anything, right?
Interesting.
But the whole point is it wants to get you in a very agile way to stand up this environment and give almost immediate business value, right, to your organization. That's kind of what it wants to do, right?
Very cool. Well, thanks for that. Appreciate it. Good. Well, I think this was very helpful, very interesting, good topics, obviously. So I appreciate your time today. Our hour went by like so fast, very quickly. So we'll have to have you come back again. And thanks again for Dean bringing us you to the forefront today. And I think everybody enjoyed it. As I mentioned, we recorded, so you'll have the recording sent to you as well. And anybody who came in late or wants to listen to the recording can do so in a couple of days. It'll be up and live.
Thank you very much for having me. Happy to come back if you ever would like to continue the conversation.
Yeah, it was awesome. Thank you so much. And I appreciate everyone's attendance tonight. Thank you, Dr. Bacard, for facilitating as well. I think he's still there. Yeah, thank you. And all the students and faculty that were able to join. It was an awesome fit. Thank you so much. Have a great evening, everyone. Bye-bye.